Introduction to the associated online guidance document noted on this slide. This guidance document was produced by ITRC in 2018. We can't cover all the information, tools, and resources available in this guidance document, so please visit the website and take a look at it if you have not already done so. We hope it will serve as a resource for you and work as you work on your environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Today's training is scheduled for about 2 hours and 15 minutes, and as I said, is being recorded. While we are in the Zoom webinar, you are unable to access the live web links on our slide deck. You can download the slide deck from the main course training page under Webinar Slides tab. In Zoom, you have access to the Q&A window where you can ask questions or report any technical issues during this training. We will have 2 Q&A breaks during the training, and we will get to as many questions as we can verbally. If we have too many questions to answer out loud, we will ask our trainers to respond directly back to that person through the chat feature on the Zoom webinar Q&A. There is also an online feedback form for you to complete to let us know how the training went today. By completing this feedback form, you will be eligible to receive your certificate of completion to support your documentation of continuing education. At the end of the feedback form, you will check the box that you certified, that you certify that you participated, and then you'll submit your form. Afterwards, the certificate will be emailed to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, please visit our website or feel free to contact us directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can become an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on our website. If you do plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC accordingly. ITRC is partially funded by the U.S. government. ITRC nor the U.S. government warranty the materials nor endorse any specific products from today's training. On slide number 5, I appreciate the opportunity to introduce our expert trainers today. All of them have been active members of ITRC's LNAPL team over the years. Not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, they have dedicated many hours to develop this guidance document. Special thanks for them all. Thank you to them all for participating today. And our trainers today are Randy Chapman from the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality and Natasha Cihoda from Chevron and Sanjay Garg from Shell. And with that, I'm going to hand it off to Randy to start us. So Randy, I did just give you remote control. If you would just click your screen, then you'll have full control. And then when you're ready to hop off mute.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
I'm sorry. My
All right.
Computer is, are you getting feedback?
Nope, you sound good.
Okay, good. Welcome, everybody. I'm going to go to the next slide. All right. Welcome to LNAPL, light non-aqueous phase liquids. Welcome to 2022. Why are we here today? Why are we going to talk about LNAPL? LNAPL is light non-aqueous phase liquids. Why do we care? Why do we give a hoot about it? Because it's not just the presence of the LNAPL that could be an issue at your site. It is what it can do for the dissolve phase or the vapor phase. And that's one of the concerns that we have, because you can put a well at a site and never see any product. And again, use the term LNAPL, but I'm sure a lot of you have used different terminology of free product, stuff, oil, whatever you want to say. Here we're going to be using the term LNAPL. But it's important that you recognize that when LNAPL is present, it can create certain concerns. And so we're going to learn about today. We're going to talk about the key concepts. Today's training is to help you understand the science. And that's why it's important that we understand these things. All right. So on the next one here, next two slides, I'm just going to jump through, because basically LNAPL is discussed all over the country. A lot of the state programs have guidance and have moved forward to better understand the concerns associated with LNAPL. I first got involved earlier on, and I worked with my co-team lead, Eric Gessert, out of Colorado, to work on this latest update of the LNAPL guidance. All right, little history real quick. Back in the 2000s, we had the original versions of the LNAPL guidance, the natural source on depletion, which we're going to discuss, and the LNAPL 2 evaluating LNAPL remedial technologies. Between 2010, 2017, we did online training, in-person training. Yes, there was a time when we actually all could see each other in person. And we had a lot of training, and it worked great. But then we realized after a few years that we needed to update the existing guidance. So in 2016, a lot of the folks who were involved with the original effort, we came back together and created the updated LNAPL 3, LNAPL site management, LNAPL conceptual site model, evolution, decision process, and created what we have today. And in the spring of 2018, we started the online training again. All right. Okay, so a lot of guidance. And as you noticed, this is a three-part training session. So not everything that's in the guidance can be covered in the training session. So obviously there's a lot of information on our webpage, on the ITRC site, that will provide you additional information. So certainly go there to download the chapters, the sections, the relevant documents, the appendix, and all the charts that you're going to be using. And so it's going to provide a lot more information that we can today and in the next two sessions. All right, but today we're going to focus on the key concepts. The science, because if you don't understand the science, you're going to have a very difficult time, in my opinion, of understanding the difficulties and concerns and the issues that you have to address at sites where there's LNAPL. Now, one of the things that I'm going to personally say, and I've been doing this since 90, is the issue of the conceptual site model, which we're going to get into later on, not today, but in the later sessions. If you can understand the site, it's not just the normal conceptual site model that you would do, but also incorporating the LNAPL issues. Because if you don't do that, again, personal opinion is you're not really going to be able to come up with the right solution for this particular site. This updated guidance also talks about the SMART objectives. And those are objectives that are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely. I think we all agree if we had $1 million per site, a million years, we could take care of most of them. We don't. So what we do needs to be smart. We need to make sense. And probably the other ones that we talk about is, can you actually measure it, the success? Can you actually attain what you need to do? And is it relevant to your particular site? Just because you did something on one site doesn't mean you need to do it on another site. So these are the things that the objectives that you need to look at. We're also, under this guidance, going to talk more than we did before about LNAPL transmissivity. And for me, an important one is the natural source zone depletion, letting the natural conditions help move the site forward with degradation and depletion of the LNAPL, and to help to get a realistic, achievable closure. And that's one of those things I think we need to start incorporating more of in our decision-making process. All right. This guidance is for everybody. In my program here in Virginia, we do all petroleum from heating oil tanks to the large bulk storage terminals. And my staff will tell you, I always say this all the time, as a duck is a duck is a duck. We don't really care what tank it came out of, what the regulatory status was. These are still issues of LNAPL, whether it's a home heating oil case, they may have a private supply well, or a bulk storage terminal. The issues and the underlying science are going to be the same. So this document can be used by anybody in the profession, in the regulatory scenarios, the academics, professionals, the community, the public, so they understand what's going on at this site. And that the way it's written, it is understandable. All right. Next, again, all types of petroleum, not just gasoline, but diesel, aviation fuel, heating oil, anything. And it's not just the big fancy sites. It's every site that this applies to. Okay. Again, bulk terminals to the mom and pops. Now, today's session, we're going to focus on the underlying science and how it's going to be used at your site. And again, not to belabor the point, if you don't understand the science, the key concepts we're going to talk about today, I personally believe you're going to have a very difficult time coming up with the right solution. In the later sessions, we're going to, part two, we'll talk about developing the LNAPL conceptual site model and how to talk to stakeholders and decision makers about what you're doing. In the last session, part three, we talk about selecting the remedial technologies. And here's the next one that I don't think our industry has probably done enough of, is the transitioning. If you attack a site with one technology or one strategy at the beginning, it doesn't mean that that's the same technology or strategy you're going to use the whole time. And I think it's important that when you're making these decisions, that you can have conversations with your management, the public, the site owners, about how you may transition from one, let's say, an active strategy to a less active strategy to different approaches, so that everybody's on the same page as to what we're planning on doing and how we're going to do it and how long it's going to take. And again, the smart issues about how to measure it and show that there's progress. And that would be in part three. All right. Last thing is, how does it tie to the guidance, the training sessions? Today's section is primarily found in section three of the guidance. Next week's training session will be found primarily in sections four and five. And the last one is the remedy sections are in section six. But today we're going to focus on the science. All right. You'll see this chart. You'll see it in the guidance, and we use these kind of flow charts. And again, color coded so you see what sections of the guidance it applies to. Today's, again, important. We're going to just talk about the science, because again, if we don't understand the science, we're not going to be able to make the right decision to make the right talking to everybody about what we need to do and how we move forward. All right, I'm going to finish up here. I'm going to turn over to Sanjay, and then I believe I am back at the end to kind of wrap up and talk about some questions. So Sanjay, it's all yours, and talk to you guys later.
All right, thanks, Randy. Let me see how to. Okay, so the way the rest of the webcast or internet-based training is set up is we have 9 key messages that Natasha Sihor and I will walk you through. And hopefully this will set you up for success for our internet-based training 2 and 3. So some of the key messages that we'll go through is that LNAPL in wells does not mean that 100% of the LNAPL, 100% of the soil pores are filled with LNAPL, right? Then Randy mentioned it earlier that LNAPL can be present in the subsurface, but it may not show up in your wells. And what are the indicators to actually see if you have LNAPL in your in the subsurface, in the ground? In all three internet-based trainings and your technology selection, building your CSM, et cetera, you'll hear a lot in this internet-based training about composition versus saturation. Composition is what it is, and saturation means how much it is. And we'll kind of talk about how composition is relevant. We, in an industry, in this industry, we measure LNAPL thicknesses in wells, and these thicknesses fluctuate, they change with different soil type, et cetera, and we'll kind of talk through that, that how different geologies and different water table conditions affect the thickness in the wells. Talked about number five already. And then this is, there's a perception that LNAPL, if you see it in wells, quote unquote free product, the perception is that the fact that it's there, it must have gotten there somehow, so it must still be moving, right? And we'll talk about that. Yes, it got there, but it's not a perpetual process. Randy talked about transmissivity a little bit. It's a, we'll introduce the concept today, what it means technically as a fundamental science, and then you'll see more in IBT2, but transmissivity, why is it a better indicator of recoverability instead of thickness? A little bit about sheens, what causes sheens, and towards the end, we'll talk about these biological processes, especially this new, no longer new, but in the last 10 years, it's taken a lot of momentum in the last 5 years more so, natural source zone depletion. So the first key message that we'll go through is that when there's LNAPL in monitoring wells, that does not mean your pore space is 100% filled with LNAPL. So in this slide, you see four timestamps of a release and how that kind of manifests itself in the environment. So in the first picture, the brown is the Vero zone, the blue is the saturated zone, you've got an underground storage tank leaking, and that LNAPL starts reaching the water table. Initially, the water table offers some resistance to that LNAPL and starts mounding, as you see here. After some time, there's a sufficient of a release, a sufficient release that the resistance that's offered by the saturated pore space is overcome and the LNAPL kind of pushes through. Imagine an ice pushing an ice cube below the water, right? And then because LNAPL is lighter than water, the release has stopped in timestamp three. Everything that was in the Vero zone has kind of drained down. Most of it has drained down. And the LNAPL has gone below the water table. And now because of buoyancy, some of that NAPL is coming up. So that's where you see these yellow colors, which means less NAPL in the ground. Red colors means more NAPL in the ground. And at some time, eventually, there is this profile that's generated. This is idealist, ideal profile, but conceptually that's what happens is you've got the smear zone, which was created when the LNAPL initially went down, but then buoyancy kicks in and then some NAPL that shows up in the wells, right? So this is called vertical equilibrium in kind of in the literature. Basically, all it's saying is then all the vertical forces have come to a balance and it's reached an equilibrium. So imagine a, again, think of that ice cube that we talked about. You pushed it down and once you remove that pressure from the ice cube, remove your finger from that ice cube, it'll come up and it'll stabilize at some stage and that, in that stage, that ice cube has reached a vertical equilibrium. So same kind of concept for the LNAPL here. So that was all kind of illustrative pictures. This is a tank experiment. Kristen Bruce, who's my colleague at Shell, she did it as part of her PhD work. But basically what you're seeing here is a tank, a few inches kind of perpendicular to the plane of your screen or your paper, and a few feet left to right. And I was 3-4 feet deep, approximately. So they generated a simulated a spill with this red dyed NAPL. The water table is shown in the picture. The NAPL comes down, and it's kind of the second picture on the previous slide where NAPL's gone below the water table. And if you wait for, this is like minutes after the release, and if a quote unquote release, and if you wait a few hours, it's reached some sort of a vertical equilibrium. The NAPL is penetrated below the water table. If you squint your eyes, you just kind of see there's a little bit of color difference, at least in this picture, you see a color difference. That means some of the NAPL that had initially gone down came up with buoyancy, spread out till it's reached some sort of a equilibrium condition. Another tank experiment, you'll hear from Andrew in, I think, IBT2 or IBT3. And this is a tank experiment that he did in his garage, or tank visualization that he did in his garage. The yellow here is the fluorescent dyed LNAPL. So you can dye your LNAPL with the fluorescent material. You can find buy that in your auto shop and then look at it in a UV light. So what you're seeing is a monitoring well stuck to the screen of a wall, like a fish tank filled with sand. And what I want you to look here is the LNAPL in the well, which is this bright yellow area. It's like, obviously this is LNAPL in the well. When you look in the formation next to it, you see these LNAPL kind of specks, but it's not 100% pore space that's filled with LNAPL, right? So water was already there when the spill happened in environment, in this tank, in the previous tank. So LNAPL cannot remove all the water, and it kind of coexists with the water. And depending on how big a release and what type of release, et cetera, it just, and what type of soil, depends on how much, kind of that just governs how much water it's, the LNAPL is able to push out. And you'll see that in the upcoming sections. So kind of to wrap this section up, many of us who've been long enough in the industry have heard the term pancake model. There are a couple of mental pictures that come to mind with this pancake model. The first one that comes to mind is, if the NAPL is light material, it's lighter than water, it's just floating on top. And now you've inserted a monitoring well, and it's just draining into the well. And there are old kind of rules of thumb where people say, hey, there's an exaggeration of 4 times, 10 times. When LNAPL enters a well, just divide it by 4 and you'll see, you'll get what's in the formation. Or divide it by 10 and you'll get it what's in the formation. So that's not correct. Because this is not what's happening in the environment. The other kind of LNAPL model is, we are used to having wells for water in the ground, right? And when you have water in the well, the formation next to the well is 100% saturated with water. And that's the correct conceptual model. That's the correct thinking. And what happens is, what has happened is, we've extrapolated that thinking or that visualization or mental model to LNAPL. And we say, okay, LNAPL is present in the well. So the thickness that I have in the well, a corresponding thickness must be present for fully saturated pores in the subsurface. And that's kind of not how you, if you took soil samples, that's not what's happening. What's actually realistic or representative is what you see in the third picture, where you have LNAPL in the well, and both LNAPL and water actually flow into the well, right? So the water from here, LNAPL from here, they're both entering the well. But because LNAPL is lighter than water, obviously it'll float on top. So you see this layer accumulating in a well. So the key message here is LNAPL and water, they share a pore space. And when you see LNAPL in monitoring wells, it does not mean that your pore space is fully saturated. So with this, I will hand over to Natasha Sihora from Chevron.
Thanks, Sanjay. So in this section, we'll talk about key message number two. And this key message is that LNAPL can be in the formation even when it's not accumulating in wells. A couple of the things that we'll touch on here. Firstly, we'll talk about the question of how do you know that NAPL is present if you're not seeing it accumulating in a monitoring well? And then how do you find out where it is? So one thing to keep in mind is that it's all NAPL. So there's really a spectrum that it exists across, from residual through mobile and migrating. And how we think about this is that at the lower saturations, LNAPL can be present, but it's not flowing into the wells. And then at higher saturations, LNAPL can be mobile and then even migrate. Really at the higher end of this spectrum is where we have the concerns, the saturation concerns around the mobility and migration. But across the full range here, we do have potential composition concerns. Just to give you an idea here, we have a cross-section looking at a case where we have NAPL present in a couple of our monitoring wells. So this monitoring well here in the middle and this further down gradient monitoring well, we're actually observing measurable NAPL in those wells. But then we have this sort of halo of NAPL present in the formation, not necessarily represented in the monitoring wells. And so this is something that we need to keep in mind, that depending on the material that it's in, we can have a reasonable amount of NAPL present in the formation as well. And this is something that we'll touch on again and again, thinking about how does the geology play into how that NAPL is going to behave in the subsurface. So if there is a persistent dissolve phase feeding the groundwater, then this is an indication that there's a NAPL source. So if there's something that's causing these groundwater concentrations to remain elevated, that's a good indicator that we do have a NAPL source present. And this is, again, it may not be flowing into the well, but if we continue to see elevated concentrations of our constituents of concern in the groundwater, there's something that is sort of causing that or feeding that, which is likely an LNAPL source. And one way that we can think about this is the effective solubility of the different chemicals that we're interested in. So for example, here we have a table showing the pure phase chemical solubility for our different compounds of concern. So looking at benzene, toluene, xylene in different kinds of NAPL mixtures. So in gasoline or diesel, you can kind of imagine how this would relate to other types of hydrocarbons as well, or other hydrocarbon mixtures. And then when we look at the mole fraction of these compounds in unweathered NAPL, that can enable us to calculate the effective solubility of that chemical in that mixture. And this kind of gets back to that idea of thinking, how can we evaluate whether there's a NAPL source feeding our groundwater plume? So the likelihood of that LNAPL source being present in the vicinity of an observed groundwater concentration, it increases as we move towards that effective solubility. So as our concentration of our constituent of concern approaches that effective solubility, it's more likely that we have a NAPL source that's feeding that groundwater location. Another thing that we can look at is the CSAT values. So here we're looking at TPH, or total petroleum hydrocarbons in soil. And this bulk measurement really represents the hydrocarbons as well as the that are present in the soil gas, pore water, and on the sorb phase, as well as any NAPL present itself. And so this indicates the concentration, or when we compare this to the CSAT value, it indicates whether or not we likely have NAFLD present. So if we have TPH reported from our lab or from our field measurements that are above the CSAT value, then this is another indicator that we have L-NAFLD present at the site. And this table here on the bottom shows us again, for different L-NAFLD types, and importantly here for different soil types, what we can expect those CSAT values to be. So something just to pay attention to here is that there's quite a range of CSAT values depending both on that NAFLD type and on the soil type. So thinking about your conceptual site model and characterization and the value of understanding these aspects of the site when you're looking to evaluate NAFLD presence and behavior. There are a couple of cautions that we wanted to make sure we point out related to TPH. So one is we don't want to collect soil samples at predetermined intervals. We do want to make sure that we're collecting soil samples based on field screening. We want to make sure that, of course, we're looking at a TPH range that's appropriate for the L-NAFLD type. So, you know, if you have a crude oil, you probably don't want to be looking at TPH gasoline. So just making sure that the lab is going to report back useful data for you. And then don't stop at the water table. We want to make sure that we capture that full smear zone, which will really help in the selection and design of remedial alternatives. So what this, could this potentially look at or look like at a site? So here we can infer the L-NAFLD from soil TPH concentrations. On the left-hand side, we have a typical plan view of a site. Our groundwater is flowing from the top left down to the bottom right. And then we have the locations of various monitoring wells where we have historic benzene concentrations and the maximum soil concentrations, I guess, collected in the soil borings when the wells were installed. So we can, of course, use this to evaluate the extent of the groundwater plume, and then also look at these locations where we expect that NAFLD will be present. So I think this is maybe being cut off a little bit by the bottom of the slide here, but we can see that L-NAFLD is present in monitoring well 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, which then is correlated well with those CSAT values and the solubility of benzene. So looking at, again, those measurements and comparing them to what we would expect to see if we had pure phase solubility or if we had, or what our CSAT value is for the soil. So just another way that we can kind of use our screening data or our early data evaluation to understand what's going on at our site. This is another cross-section of the same site here, showing again the locations where we do have L-NAFLD accumulating in monitoring wells, and just to point out that we can have this L-NAFLD present in the formation, maybe at concentrations, or excuse me, at saturations a little bit lower that are not necessarily accumulating in wells, so here at MW5, but our soil TPH values do still indicate that we have some hydrocarbon present there that we need to keep in mind. We talked a little bit about the laboratory methods. There are, of course, some good field methods that are going to provide a lot of useful data. So having a good evaluation of your boring logs, making sure that you're characterizing the extent of the L-NAFLD identified in the boring logs, as well as the lithology. Just going back to the idea of L-NAFLD behavior in different soil types that we'll see a little bit more going through this IBT, and how that's going to relate to its behavior overall at the site. Some of the quick screening methods we can use, these oleophilic dyes that Sanjay mentioned a little bit before, that we can use for sort of quick screening of detection below a certain threshold. And then we can also use fluorescent measurements with direct push technology, such as the LIF. One thing to keep in mind is that all NAFLDs do not fluoresce. So we see here on the top left the fluorescence of different NAFLDs, and you can see that there's quite a range of how well the hydrocarbons fluoresce or not. So keeping in mind that you need to have some awareness of what type of hydrocarbon you expect at the site. For example, a weathered crude oil is probably not going to give you the best fluorescence. So you need to be thinking about what that is and how that will relate to the ability to use these types of tools. But they can be really good characterization tools for the site. And then finally, we can do a little bit more detailed work in the lab to look at pore fluid saturations. So we can collect samples and use this Dean-Stark extraction to enable us to understand what the LNAPL saturation is in the pore space. And that gets back to where we started this key message, thinking about how much, or what is the level of saturation in the sample, and how could that potentially relate to mobility or migration concerns. And I will pass it back to Sanjay.
Thanks, Natasha. The next key message that we'll walk through is how saturation and composition affect our decision, or how can they affect our decision, why they should. So we'll start with this concept of effective solubility. Natasha used it a little bit in her slides earlier. So I've got three vials, bottles, and what you see here is kind of, the first bottle has got xylene, which is one of the chemicals, and gasoline, and some water, and I shake them up for a few minutes, and I take a sample of this water. That's at the bottom. And these little dots are not droplets. These are just molecules, conceptually. And if I take that sample, the concentration of the water would be 170 milligrams per liter. That's the solubility of xylene. If I do the same experiment with octane, I'll get 600 micrograms of 0.6 milligrams per liter, because that's the solubility of octane. When I mix both of these up, and both of these are components of gasoline, but not in this fraction what I have here, but for an experiment, I said I have 80% octane and 20% xylene, and I do the same experiment. The concentrations that I'll get in the water are 20% of 170 milligrams per liter, and then 80% of 0.6 milligrams per liter, which is 4.48 milligrams per liter, right? The same results, you'll see the same results if I put in a third of the xylene, third of the octane, and third of the blend in these vials. These concentrations will still be the same. If I put a tenth, you'll still get the same results. So that's what Raoult's law says. If you look at Raoult's law, all it's saying is the solubility of a compound in a mixture is its mole fraction in the mixture and the solubility of it as a pure compound, pure chemical. Nowhere in this relationship you see a term that accounts for the amount of LNAPL. Right, so that's an important message, that the equilibrium concentration that you'll see in groundwater is dependent on what it is, and that's defined by this mole fraction term, but it's independent of how much it is. And okay, so we'll do a thought experiment in the next, on this slide, and kind of compare different scenarios. So I have a base case where I've got this impacted area, rectangular area, which has got some hydrocarbon or NAPL spill in it. And let's say it takes some time, which we represent as one. One could mean 100 years, it could mean 10 years, it could mean 1 year. And it's got a concentration of one, right? And that's our base case, and we'll compare it with different scenarios. The second scenario is that I've gone and removed 50% of that concentration from the top, right? So for example, there was an excavation and I was able to get to the top 50%, and I removed the top 50%, left the bottom half. The concentration in this case will go down by a factor of half or factor of two, but it'll take just as long for this area to wash through with natural groundwater flow. The third scenario is I've excavated or cleaned up half of the soil in the direction of flow. As you can see here, the white area is cleaned up. So for example, maybe a building came over here, or the dispensers were present in this area and you could not get to it, right? A budget ran out, whatever it was. In that case, your concentration will not change in this monitoring well, but the duration will become half. The fourth scenario is where I'm able to go in and pump the LNAPL out, right? and I'm able to reduce the saturation, the amount of LNAPL by 20%, which is kind of a not an unreasonable number, probably a representative number in most cases, that's the ballpark that you could probably remove LNAPL, in some cases more, some cases less. But let's say you are able to remove 20%. In that case, your concentration does not change at all, but your duration goes down by 20%. And the last scenario is where I'm able to go in and whatever my chemical of concern, let's say it's benzene, right, in this scenario, and I'm able to reduce the concentration of benzene in that mixture by 80%. Everything else is the same, but I've reduced just that one chemical by 80% selectively. In that case, your concentration goes down by 80%. Remember that X on the previous slide, that mole fraction? It's gone down proportionally to that, but it'll take just as long as your base case, but your concentration is reduced. So this is an ideal scenario, kind of conceptual, but this informs our thinking and this should kind of educate us to, as we build our conceptual models. This is a study that we did many years back. The citation for this is Kulkarni et al. 2015, is I think when we published this. And these are data from about 800 gas stations from the California Public Database, GeoTracker. And there were sites, about the 800 sites, about 450 sites did not have LNAPL recovery performed during this period, 2001 to 2011. And then half, and the red dots of the sites that had LNAPL recovery performed. Total number of sites, 800, about 450 that didn't have NAPL recovery, 350 that had LNAPL recovery. And the way to look at this graph is at the bottom axis, x-axis here. These are the maximum highest concentrations, right? So this is how bad or the worst case condition in the last 10 years. And then on the y-axis is the most recent. So the farther away that you are from the no change line, the higher the reduction that you obtain, right? This OOM is order of magnitude. And just visually, you can see there's really not a difference between the red dots and the green dots. They're both reduced or not reduced, depending on the sites. But LNAPL recovery did not have an impact on it, kind of because the composition did not change. It's just the saturation changed by a little bit. So how do you change the composition? We kind of go to the basics of the physicochemical properties of these materials, or these chemicals that you're trying to remove. And some of the basic properties are how soluble it is, how volatile it is from NAPL, how volatile is it from water, and how fast does it degrade, right? And so each of these properties affects is the underlying principles around some basic technologies. So if you look at pump and treat, it basically works for MTB and TBA. I'm just looking at some examples from gasoline mixtures. But when you come to BTEX type materials or even heavier chemicals, I mean, their solubility is so low that you can't wash the soil out. You can't pump it out enough. And the red line is kind of the threshold where we think that the team that put this material together, we all think that that's a reasonable threshold for the technology to work. When you look at volatilization from LNAPL, that's, you look at vapor pressure, things like MTBE, benzene, those are good chemicals to kind of strip out of the LNAPL using SVE, but some of the other materials are really not as volatile. You'll get some of them out, but they're not as volatile. And once you get to the pHs or xylene, ethylbenzene, they're much lower than what you could effectively strip by a vapor. For water, you use at Henry's law constant against certain chemicals that are not as strippable from oil, can be stripped from water because they're not soluble also. So just they don't like staying in water either, and you can strip them, and air sparge is a good technique for those kind of chemicals. And then biodegradation, some chemicals degrade more under aerobic conditions, some degrade more under anaerobic conditions, sulfate reducing conditions, et cetera. So it's hard to engineer biodegradation to be compound specific, but it's, you could do that just under aerobic condition naturally or by adding oxygen, and the BTEX compounds will degrade. So just quickly, a little pause to for a knowledge check. So consider a site with the gasoline release, and you see a NAPL in some of the monitoring wells that are on site, and your goal is to reduce concentration of benzene in the groundwater in a couple of years. Which of these three options do you think would get you, has the most chance of you being successful in that time frame? I'm assuming, Devin, that we'll see the results in a second.
Yep, just one more second to let some more participants answer.
Okay. Okay, so maybe a bit of a discussion here. So yeah, monitoring natural attenuation, take its course, probably won't do it in 2 years. Two-thirds of you said LNAPL composition change that. That's what we talked about. A third of you still said remove LNAPL, start removing LNAPL by pumping. From a regulatory perspective, that may be a requirement and we might need to do it, right? But if your objective, from a technical perspective, your objective is to reduce benzene, what will get you there is change of LNAPL composition through SVE, air sparge, something like that. But removing LNAPL by pumping will not reduce your benzene concentration. And the examples, if you go back, I won't change the slide, but that graph that I had where we looked at half the sites had LNAPL recovery, half did not, really no difference in how fast the benzene concentration decreased in those. In that case, or if you recall the bottle experiment, if I reduce the LNAPL in the bottle by even 90%, those concentration won't change. So the right answer is the change the LNAPL composition. And I'm hoping that as we walk through more of these scenarios, you'll appreciate that a bit more. So with that, Natasha will take you through the next key message.
Thanks, Sanjay. In this key message, we will talk about how all apparent LNAPL thickness are not created equal, and particularly focus on LNAPL thickness in unconfined conditions. So we'll start off by going back to comparing different soil types. So we're looking here at moisture retention curves for a sand and for a clay. And what you can see right off the bat is that we have very different behavior in these two materials. And this is going to be really important for thinking about how LNAPL moves around in different types of material. So we use these moisture retention curves to look at the relationship between the fluid saturation in different types of lithologies. And this can be quite helpful to understanding LNAPL behavior. So this figure shows you the difference in LNAPL distribution, vertical distribution, in different material types. So what we're looking at is the LNAPL saturation on the x-axis, and then the height above the water LNAPL interface on the y in feet. And this is all for the same thickness or the same height of gasoline in a monitoring well, shown on the right here. So what we can see is that for the same amount of gasoline in the monitoring well, we have very different LNAPL saturations in the formation. So in a silt, the LNAPL isn't sort of pushing into the material very far. It's being held quite close to the monitoring well. Versus in a gravel, we have this large shark fin sort of behavior, which you'll hear referred to a number of times here. But so there's a much larger extent of LNAPL in the formation, which would enable that thickness in the monitoring well. And so this really underlines the importance of understanding your soil type when you're looking at understanding the LNAPL behavior at a site, because you will have very different behavior for the different lithologies. And going back to one of Sanjay's points earlier, we show here as well this pancake model that we really are pushing people to get away from. But if you're estimating a volume based on that pancake model, which is that light pink shaded area, you're really, really going to overestimate the volume. So you need to be taking into consideration what the soil type is and understanding that behavior and those implications for the saturations of the NAPL in the formation. So this is just a different view now, again, looking at this very characteristic shark fin behavior. So we're looking at LNAPL saturation again on the x-axis. And the height of the LNAPL water, the height above the LNAPL water interface. And this is just to underline that for a given soil type, the higher thickness in the well creates that higher capillary pressure and ultimately a higher NAPL saturation. So this is just for one soil type now. We're just looking for a silty sand and showing that for 1 foot thickness in a well, that's about maybe 2.5% LNAPL saturation. And then if we were all the way up to 10-foot thickness, we're up at about 35% LNAPL saturation. So just kind of showing another way to look at that type of information. And then just a cute little graphic on the bottom right here showing, again, we have this kind of characteristic shark fin behavior that we see. And it gets talked about a lot. So now if we were to use the information on different soil types to understand our site, and the LNAPL behavior at our site, how would this work? So on the left-hand side, we're looking at, for a homogeneous soil, so we just have one soil type here, we have the modeled LNAPL thickness based on our monitoring well information, and then we also have samples, which are shown in the little triangles. And we can see that for the homogeneous case, we have a pretty good match between the modeled and the measured data. And then on the right-hand side, we, in this case, we have a very heterogeneous soil type. So we have six different soil types here. And we see that, you know, there's some relationship between the modeled and the measured data, but it's very different than the case on the left-hand side. And so just really, again, underlining the importance of understanding what different soil types you have and how that is going to relate to the LNAPL behavior at your site, particularly around the saturations that you may expect. And I will pass it back to Sanjay for key message five.
All right. Thanks, Natasha. So Natasha talked about how the shark fin changes with different soil types. We'll just talk a little bit more about different hydrogeologic conditions, how the thickness in the wells really change, and all thickness aren't really, don't tell you the same thing. You have to interpret it with in context of your hydrogeologic conditions. So this is a, while we wait for it to start up, this is a video that shows the LNAPL thickness, which is that blob in the middle. The pink color is zero thickness. The hotter colors are up to 4 feet of thickness. On the right side, you see this bar of what the groundwater elevation is, right? And just look at them both together, the blob and the bar. So as the bar goes higher, the blob disappears or gets smaller. And as the bar goes down, the blob gets bigger and the thickness is increased, right? So right now, the water table is high, the blob disappeared, and then it's coming back. Yeah. And this is a refinery with about 50-ish wells. This is a diesel plume or diesel NAPL blob. And it's a coarse-grained material under unconfined conditions. Okay. Just waiting for the slides to come back up. Okay. And this is a slide, basically screen grabs from the previous slide. So I guess if somebody was fast enough, they go and put in a request for closure in 1986, September, and by the time that report's processed, the water table drops and you're back at your LNAP thickness. So that was meant to be a joke, but going to the next slide. So why does that happen? This is a slide from Colorado State University, Dr. Tom Sale's student. I think it was Allison Hawkins. Oh, if I can go back, let me figure out how to go back. One second. Oops. Okay. So what you have here is, again, one of those tank experiments. The fluorescent material, the yellowish material, is NAPL. There's a monitoring well or simulated monitoring well that's kind of stuck to the tank. And in the first case, you have a higher water level, water table, somewhere around here, and you've got a certain thickness in the well, right? And as that water table drops, this NAPL, look at the color difference between the left panel and the right panel. A lot of that LNAPL that was trapped below the water table is now getting freed, essentially, and then it accumulates in a well. Right? So as the water table is dropping, or the water table drops, you get more LNAPL, and as the water table rises, the LNAPL gets smeared, and there's less of it to accumulate in a well. And that's what's shown in these pictures in the middle as well. So in an unconfined condition, so these are four different ways of drawing your potentiometric surfaces or your NAPL thicknesses with time. And the A and C, the first one here and the last one over here, this basically just a time series of water level and LNAPL thickness. And this is a time series of water level and LNAPL, and kind of the calculated water table was, or the corrected water table or piezometric surface in this purple line, right? So these are kind of standard graphs that you'll see in your quarterly reports or semi-annual reports, what have you. I would want you to focus on the other two because they can tell us more, and they can give us more information and more easily. Over here, just look at the water table elevation and LNAPL thickness. It's kind of a graph. As the water table elevation is increasing, the LNAPL thickness is decreasing, right? There's no timestamp, so it's easier to see what's happening. This is something that the community, the environmental community is calling as diagnostic gauge plots. This is elevation, and I can't see the bottom axis here. Let me hang on. Give me 1 second. Yeah. Part of my screen is covered here. And I'm trying to figure out how to get to it. Okay, I can't. Apologies for that. Okay, so this is elevation and this is LNAPL thickness at the x-axis. I'm hoping that you can see your the axis labels. But what I want you to notice, kind of both of these lines are going down, the air LNAPL interface and the LNAPL water interface. And now let's look at another condition, which is so that was unconfined. You can have this perch condition where you the LNAPL percolates down and it encounters some sort of a finer grain layer, and LNAPL kind of sits on top. And when you install a monitoring well, the LNAPL kind of percolates into the well, and it'll continue to happen as long as there's sufficient LNAPL on that layer. It'll continue to happen till these two levels kind of meet up, right? And in the second half of the slide, or second, the right-hand side panel, basically the water table dropped, and assuming there's enough LNAPL sitting on this layer, It'll just keep percolating down till it fills it up, so fills the well up. So at all times, under equilibrium conditions, when there's you've given it enough time to reach an equilibrium, your air LNAPL interface, this interface will stay flat. And the LNAPL water interface changes with will go down. And this is at the bottom half of the slide is an actual, so this is conceptual at the top, and this is from an actual site. So you can use this diagnostic gauge plots to actually infer your geology at the site, at least at that localized level. And that'll explain to you why your thicknesses are behaving the way they are. Another scenario, kind of the invert scenario of that, where you've got LNAPL that reached below the water table or in the unconfined area at some point. Which reached below the water table. And as the water table is rising, it encounters some sort of a confining layer. It doesn't have to be a very tight layer, like a clay. In this case, it's a clay, but it could be something just a reasonable contrast with gravel in this particular example. And as the water table is rising or water table rises, this LNAPL kind of is unable to penetrate the pores of this tighter material. And it fills up this monitoring well till it reaches an equilibrium condition. So think of it as sort of a inverted syringe, and you're applying pressure, and if you apply pressure, that needle fills up, and if the more pressure you apply, the needle kind of fills up. And in this case, the LNAPL water interface, right, that really does not change, but your air LNAPL interface changes depending on how much thickness you have. So this is a data from a real site, and the boring log kind of shows that about 800 feet elevation, there is this contrast from coarse sand to silty sand. So when the water level was below the silty sand layer, the LNAPL thicknesses were going down as the water level was rising. So that was our first slide where I said that, where I put up those four graphs. This is showing the first half of that scenario. Get to that, right? So that's the first half. And then as the groundwater elevation starts, so the piezometric surface starts to go higher than 800, the thickness increases, because now imagine that inverted syringe type of scenario, you're applying pressure and the LNAPL in the monitoring wells is increasing. Another scenario happens in fractured rock, happens in Texas, where you've got really tight clays and you've got these macro pores. And those could be due to roots, due to desiccation, those kind of things. And on the left-hand side, you have a picture, a slab picture of a core, came from our colleague, Mark Adamski, who worked for BP at the time. The little holes that you see, these halos, these little tiny holes are macro pores, and the halos that you see around them is kind of LNAPL oozing out of that, that hole. And the rest of the core is completely NAPL free. Right. And if that's what's in your formation, so this is kind of the cartoon of what your formation looks like, and you insert a monitoring well, or you kind of install a monitoring well, and you happen to get enough of these fractures or micropores intercepted by your monitoring well, then that LNAPL will flow into a well, and it'll keep bubbling up and kind of filling up the well. And it can fill up depending if there is enough NAPL and enough pore network is connected, that you can get this thickness up to tens of feet, 20 feet, 30 feet, depending on however it's, wherever it's intersecting. It may take months, years for it to reach that level if you let it sit. But in principle or in theory, it will kind of reach this sort of an equilibrium condition. And you do see that in some of the Texas refineries. So why do we care about understanding how hydrogeologic conditions affect LNAPL thicknesses. Because it affects your thickness in a well, right? So relative to the formation of the thickness, so in confined and unconfined cases or perch condition, your thickness is really not representative of what's in the formation. When you're doing your volume estimates, Natasha talked about that earlier also. If your conceptual model is incorrect and you assume that the 20 feet in my last example is all filled with LNAPL, then you do a different kind of volume estimate. You'll have that, oh my God, type of reaction versus if you kind of understood that, hey, there are some small macro pores or confined conditions that are causing those exaggerated thicknesses. Recovery can decrease over time. Like if you're in a perch condition and you're recovering, your thickness will always stay the same if you let it sit for long enough, but your recovery will change over time. It's important for understanding migration pathways, where's the LNAPL coming from? And this is all kind of feeding towards IBT 2 and 3, where it'll inform you how to effectively design your LNAPL remedy. Right, which zones to target, where's your LNAPL, how much it is. And I think I covered the last one, that the recovery rate really doesn't change. Recovery rate is constant for a perch condition because you can not create a situation by pumping where you're sucking out of the perch condition. So basically what you're doing is if you're creating a drawdown, the perch layer is just releasing LNAPL at a constant speed, right? So you exerting the aquifer will really not make any change on how fast the perch layer is yielding the LNAPL that you're trying to recover. So I think these are some of the examples why it's important. So hopefully this has created some curiosity and understanding of why it's important. And with that, I will... Are we ready for a break or it's the next section? I'll hand over to, oh, there's more? Okay, I've got one more slide, sorry. Just a quick knowledge check. A site has, in this case, 7 feet of LNAPL in a monitoring well. There's a wet season, heavy rainfall, and the LNAPL increases from 7 to 9 feet. What do you think is likely happening at the site? All right, got a mixture of results. LNAPL is confined, LNAPL is perch, LNAPL is confined. So let's just talk about the ones that got the biggest hits. LNAPL is confined. If LNAPL were confined, then you would have the scenario where the thickness goes down. If LNAPL is unconfined, you would see this. As the water level goes up, the thickness goes down, right? If LNAPL was perched, as the water table goes up, your thickness would decrease because you'll only have that much LNAPL flowing into the well and the water level is here. LNAPL is confined is the right answer because as the water table increases, you get more pressure, more LNAPL is entering the monitoring wells. LNAPL is moving or migrating, not an impossibility, it's possible, but because the water table has increased, then I would look at the history of the site and see if that's a possible explanation. So with that, I will, I think, hand over to Devin.
Yep, thank you, Sanjay. All right. Okay. So this, we will begin our first question and answer portion for today's training. At any time, please put any questions you have into the Q&A box on the bottom of your screen, and we will get to those either during the verbal portion or via the chat. Just a reminder for everybody that if you're interested in receiving certificates of completion, they will be available upon the completion of the feedback form at the end of the training session. ITRC also archives all of its training, so if you have any additional time or looking for other training opportunities, please visit ClueIn's website and the Archive Trainings tab to see if there are any courses that you would be interested in. So with that, I'm going to start reading our questions. So the first one we have is, your calculations are using standards of present products. What about products from previous centuries that have been degraded? Do you still use the present products in your formula?
Not sure which one it's, which slide it's referring to, but let me try to take a stab.
So that was during Natasha's first section, if that helps put some context to it. I can pull up the name of that section.
I know, and maybe Natasha wants to take it, but I'll start because since I started. Basically, yes, that slide is using, or the numbers are using, modern composition. And if you were to look at an older site, I think you would want to actually get the NAPL from a monitoring well in that scenario analyzed to see what an equilibrium concentration would be for a weathered product. So yes, those are all kind of standardized unweathered concentrations.
Thank you, Sanjay. I'll just pause a minute in case Natasha wants to jump in, but if not, we can move on to the next one.
No, that's great.
Okay. Thank you, Natasha. All right, so the next question. It's a little bit big, so bear with me while I, you know, read it out in full. What experience do you have with LNAPL in organic peat layers? I have a gas station site in Western Massachusetts where there is a 2 to 6 foot thickness of peat within, above, and below the water table. A release of gasoline occurred in the mid-1980s, and various remedial technologies have been implemented over the years. GWPT, HVAC, minor soil removal. This is a drinking water aquifer. Dissolved concentrations are still above DWS. No visible LNAPL has been observed in MWs for many years. New remedial strategy is hotspot soil excavation and injection of carbon injectates in peripheral areas. So the original question was, what experience do you have with LNAPL and organic peat layers?
I can start that.
Yeah, go for it.
Thanks, Sanjay. So LNAPL and peat can be a real challenge because the LNAPL wants to stick to the peat, or the hydrocarbons in general wants to stick to the peat. It sounds, without knowing too much more about this particular site, it's the challenge, I guess, of regulated to drinking water standards. But we have seen that also for TPH measurements. I'm assuming that you're probably regulated differently here, but if you're just looking at TPH, those organic rich materials like peat can also have quite a bit of background sort of apparent TPH, basically just background organic material that will also elute as if it were TPH. But so you kind of have a couple things going on there, that it's challenging to get all of the hydrocarbon out of an organic rich material, and that depending on what you're regulated on, you could also be seeing sort of an apparent bump in the TPH numbers. I don't know, Sanjay, if you want to add anything else there.
No, I think you covered it. It's, peat can be oleophilic, and there could be partitioning, or it could be just absorbed into the material.
Okay. Thank you, Sanjay and Natasha. Next question. We can quantify the soil type and even the percent moisture, but given detection of LNAPL in a MW, how is the saturation percent calculated?
Let me take a stab. Some of the conceptual ways are just through modeling, right? So you can use some of the existing models, and those are simple. You put in a soil type or soil types and put in the thickness in a well, and it'll calculate a saturation. Having said that, I mean, those are just for conceptual purposes. I mean, I wouldn't put too much stock into it, but it guides your thinking. The other thing you could do is obviously measure those, right? And there are a handful of labs that actually do a saturation measurement. The third thing you could do is if you have TPH soil concentrations, you convert them to saturation, or you can just plot your TPH concentrations, soil concentrations, as you would plot your saturation concentration, and will still inform your conceptual model. So it just depends on how you're using the saturations, kind of in a quantitative sense, but from a qualitative sense, you can get that indication from your TPH measurements.
Thank you, Sanjay. Next question. What will be the impacts of soil organic matters on LNAPL's distribution?
So I can start this. So there are some organic materials that will be sort of stickier, or, you know, as Sanjay mentioned, more oleophilic. So there are different soil types where the hydrocarbon will tend to get hung up. And, you know, and then you also have that competing issue about understanding what the natural background material is and how that could impact any measurements that you're taking. So even if it's not hydrocarbon, it can still potentially show up in your analytics based on what will come off in the standard TPH methods. Sanjay, do you want to add to that?
Just a kind of minor thing is organic carbon from a partitioning into the organic carbon, it'll affect your CSAT, but those are kind of small numbers. It really doesn't affect that much. And then the slide that Natasha showed, slide 45, even though it doesn't talk about organic carbon, it talks about grain size, but it has that clay in there that the distribution, if it's a tighter soil, the shark fin is much smaller, much skinnier. So not much gets into the pore space.
Okay. So with that, we are going to move on to the second portion of our training. We will have one more live Q&A at the end of today's training, and we'll try to get through some of these questions as well in chat. So with that, I'm going to hand it to Natasha.
Thanks. So in the next section, we'll talk about key message number 6, which is that mobile LNAPL doesn't necessarily mean that the LNAPL is migrating. So talking a little bit about the nuance of the difference here between mobility and migration concerns. And here we can really start off with this conceptual model of LNAPL management considerations. So it really helps to think about this broader context of LNAPL management. And we can begin this by looking at the LNAPL emergency issues, which are described on the left-hand panel. And so those include things like safety issues due to explosion and direct contact with NAPL. And then as we move on to the middle panel, there's the vapor and groundwater pathways. And these are the common risk pathways that are addressed by most of the regulations that we're working under. And then finally, the right-hand panel addresses the additional considerations for when LNAPL is present in wells, which could potentially present LNAPL mobility concerns or other aspects that may be due to the presence of NAPL. So things like aesthetic considerations or reputational or liability concerns. And so the focus of this section is really about that last point, which is LNAPL mobility, or excuse me, the fourth point. So although many regulatory frameworks have general provisions on LNAPL presence, LNAPL mobility is a little bit more specific. And so here we just want to give you a bit of an overview about some of these mobility considerations. So just like groundwater, we use Darcy's law to describe how NAPL behaves in the subsurface. So for anyone who doesn't remember back to, I guess when they first saw this, Darcy's law governs the fluid flow in porous media. And you see the equation here on the left, where we're looking at things like the gradient and the permeability, fluid conductivity. So then when we have a water LNAPL system, we're not just dealing with a single fluid. So really, we often have a much more complex system here, right, where we have soils and hydrocarbons and water and air. But just looking specifically at the behavior of the LNAPL, we can use Darcy's law to describe LNAPL flow just the same way as we can use it to describe water flow, except that we have the difference here that we're talking about the properties of the NAPL rather than properties of the properties of water. So next then we'll look at LNAPL conductivity and the gradient of the LNAPL. So LNAPL conductivity includes things like the density of the NAPL and the viscosity of the NAPL. And as you can imagine, this can change quite a bit depending on the particular NAPL that we're looking at. And on the right-hand side, we're looking back here at another tank experiment and with the dyed LNAPL distributed through the soils and ponding on the water table here. And so what we can see here is that we have LNAPL flowing through this vadozone, or the sort of created vadozone, this tank experiment. And then we have this sort of radial pooling on the water table shown here. And the relative permeability changes as we move across this hydrocarbon plume or this LNAPL plume here. So when we think about what happens in the real world, for a finite release, the LNAPL gradient will flatten over time. So initially, as the LNAPL is redistributing into the subsurface, we have a large volume of LNAPL present in a particular location, and then that drives the LNAPL further out from the point of release, which also causes the gradient to dissipate over time, as you see in the top figures here. And we can see also this from our tank experiment. So on the left-hand side, as shown in the white dashed line, initially we have a relatively steep LNAPL gradient, which is causing it to spread. And then on the bottom right, we see that after a relatively short time, that LNAPL gradient dissipates and stops driving the NAPL behavior. And so when we think about what's going on here, there's similar behavior when LNAPL tries to enter pores with pre-existing fluids. And so what really needs to happen is the LNAPL needs to push the existing material out of the way in order to invade that new pore space. So if we think about if we think about LNAPL moving through the vadozone, LNAPL displaces air much more easily than it's going to displace the water. When it moves into water wet material, that LNAPL needs to push the water out of the way to overcome that resistance so that it can actually enter the adjacent pore. And this is what's required then for the LNAPL to migrate. So the key point here really is that the pore entry pressure is that resistance that the LNAPL encounters when it's flowing into a pore with pre-existing groundwater. And it needs to overcome that resistance in order to continue to move. I believe Sanjay mentioned this earlier. There are a number of processes that can lead to LNAPL stability, and you'll actually hear a little bit more about this in the IBT3, I believe. So one of the main processes that causes the stability is natural source zone depletion. And these rates of natural source zone depletion or natural mass losses have been measured on the order of hundreds to the low thousands, generally, of gallons per acre per year. And what is going on here is that we have this LNAPL body that's being subjected to these environmental conditions. So things like volatilization and biodegradation, and that's causing stability and potentially, or eventually as well, sort of a shrinkage of the LNAPL body as it's subjected to these environmental conditions. So how can we look at the LNAPL behavior and use our different lines of evidence to understand what's going on? So the first thing that we can do is look at our gauging data. So here we look at our monitoring results and where we see stable or decreasing LNAPL thicknesses in our monitoring wells. That's an indicator that we have a stable LNAPL body. And similarly, if we look at our sentinel wells outside of the area of direct impacts, And we see that those are remaining free of LNAPL. There's no new LNAPL invading those areas. Then that's another good indicator that we have reached some sort of stability. Now, of course, as Sanjay mentioned, there's fluctuations due to water table changes that can happen throughout the year. So you do, of course, need to be keeping these things in mind. But this is an important line of evidence to understand NAPL behavior at your sites. The next thing that we can look at is the groundwater data. Okay, so in the groundwater data, as we talked about previously, thinking about those different chemicals and their presence and persistence in the groundwater, we can use our groundwater data and those dissolved phase plume maps to understand the source and the area and distribution of our LNAPL. We can also use the groundwater data, for example, the electron acceptors, to understand the extent to which natural attenuation is ongoing, and also to see changes that could indicate that the LNAPL body is stable or shrinking, depending on how these groundwater plumes of both of our constituents of concern, as well as any electron acceptors that we're looking at, change over time. So that's another good line of evidence that we can bring to bear to understand LNAPL behavior. A third line of evidence that we can use here is the measured LNAPL thickness, and we can compare this to a critical thickness, which would be the thickness that would be required for the LNAPL to invade those adjacent pores. And a theme that we're seeing again and again here is that these critical thicknesses are going to change based on the fuel type. So here, for example, we show a gasoline and a diesel, as well as on the soil type. So thinking about how it's important to understand the type of contaminant that you have, as well as the type of environment that you're operating in. And you can see that this has relatively large differences for what that critical thickness is that's needed for that LNAPL to migrate or to move into the adjacent pore space. So for example, on the bottom right, for a silty clay with a diesel, we need about almost 14 feet of thickness for any additional movement to occur. In contrast, for a sand, we need a very small critical thickness for diesel or for gasoline here of only about a foot. And if you think back to those shark fins that we showed, you know, much earlier in the IBT, you can see, or you can think that just how that behavior in the geologic material really relates here to this critical thickness. So there are a couple of other lines of evidence that we just wanted to highlight here. So you can look as well at LNAPL transmissivity. So for example, when you have low transmissivity, this is a good indicator of limited LNAPL and of LNAPL stability. You can look as well at the age of release, thinking about how much weathering the hydrocarbon has seen and whether or not it's likely to have reached that stable gradient. Recovery rates, decreasing LNAPL recovery rates over time is another good indicator of LNAPL stability or shrinkage. You can look back at those laboratory tests. So looking at the Dean Stark extraction that showed us information about saturation, and we can see whether we've reached that residual saturation value or if we still have higher saturations. We can potentially also use tracer tests, which use a hydrophobic dye similar to some of the dyes that we've been looking at in some of these tank experiments, to understand the NAPL behavior. And so now we'll look a little bit at putting this together and thinking through a case example. So what have we learned, or what have we observed at our site? To start off, LNAPL can initially spread at rates higher than the groundwater flow rate due to the large hydraulic head of the NAPL at the time of release. So thinking back to those tank experiments, initially you see that high gradient on the NAPL, but that dissipates relatively quickly. Secondly, the LNAPL can spread in a direction opposite to the groundwater gradient. So you can have radial spreading rather than spreading in the direction of groundwater flow. Again, this is due to that gradient that is acting on the NAPL itself at the time of that initial release. And then finally, after the LNAPL release is abated, the LNAPL bodies do come to a stable configuration within a relatively short period. So the first case example that we're looking at here is this case of an LNAPL release along a pipeline. So on the top left here, we're looking at a plan view image where we see that there is a release along this LNAPL pipeline And then we're looking in the gray contours at the change in LNAPL footprint early on in August of 2001. And then in the colored contours, we're looking in December of 2002. And the release occurred here in 2000. We know that it's a sweet Texas crude. We don't know the volume of the release. So really, a couple of key things to take away here is this goes back to the key points related to the LNAPL gradient. So we are seeing that we do have here, or a radial sort of dissipation of that LNAPL, spreading of that LNAPL early on. So we can see that the groundwater flow is generally going from the top left to the bottom right of the page, but we're seeing that there is LNAPL moving in a direction opposite to groundwater gradient, really in that radial pattern driven by the gradient on the NAPL itself. And so initially we have a relatively fast rate of spreading. Here we have on the bottom right a graph showing you the spreading in feet per day. And so initially we have a relatively fast spreading rate as we would expect. And then as that gradient begins to dissipate, we decrease the rate of spreading. Becomes really quite small relatively quickly. And so this is something that's quite characteristic of these LNAPL releases that we have, again, this radial spreading, spreading potentially in a different direction from groundwater flow, and then that gradient is dissipated quite quickly. The second case that we'll look at here is a crude oil pipeline rupture, another at a separate site. In this case, this is the Bemidji, Minnesota pipeline rupture. On the top of the slide here, we're looking at the location of the pipeline. So where my cursor is the location of the pipeline. The release occurred at this red point here, and then these dashed lines show us the extent of the LNAPL floating on the water table. The information collected on the bottom here has been collected using an LIF transect. And so we can see with the fluorescence, the areas where we have NAPL presence. So this yellow fluorescence indicates the NAPL presence along what we would call here this leading edge of the plume. And what we can see is that right at the very the very front edge of the plume, we no longer have LNAPL present as indicated by the fluorescence measurements. And we can see that this also is compared to our critical thickness value. So at the tip of the plume there, at the tip of the LNAPL body, we see that the oil thickness is less than the calculated critical thickness. And then the subsequent measurement confirms that the LNAPL was no longer able to migrate. It was no longer able to overcome that resistive force needed. And so the plume stabilized. Here we have from the same site, an example of using these natural source zone depletion measurements to evaluate the stability and the mass losses coming from the oil body. So this is the same site that we looked at in the previous slide. And we have measurements in this case of carbon dioxide flux, which can be used as a proxy for LNAPL mass depletion. So this is just bringing another line of evidence to bear to demonstrate that we have LNAPL stability and that there are these natural processes that are contributing to the stability and the decline or the removal, natural removal of the LNAPL body. And you'll hear more about this in the IBT3 as well. That really focuses on the natural depletion processes. So in summary, thinking about migration potential and stability for LNAPL, first key point here is that mobile LNAPL is not necessarily migrating LNAPL, so that the presence of NAPL in a well does not mean that it's moving. Principles of Darcy's law apply. So NAPL can spread up gradient and migrate rapidly in the early phases of a release, but it's a self-limiting process. So after after that gradient dissipates, the LNAPL is no longer going to be driven further into the formation. And that's because the LNAPL needs to overcome that pore entry pressure to move into the adjacent pore. So when you don't have enough LNAPL thickness to overcome that pore entry pressure, it's not going to be able to continue to migrate. Natural source zone depletion is an important contributor to LNAPL stability. And again, this will be described in more detail in IBT3. And then really, we always want to use multiple lines of evidence to assess LNAPL stability and understand what's going on at our sites. And now I'll pass it back to Sanjay.
All right. Thanks, Natasha. So just a quick recap of what you've heard so far regarding thickness. We talked about unconfined LNAPL and basically the thickness in the well is similar to what's in the formation. And then it smears kind of as the water table rises, the thickness drops. And as the water table falls, the thicknesses increase. Then Natasha showed you this picture of shark fins that for the same thickness in a well, in this case, 3 feet, you'll get different amounts of LNAPL depending on the soil type, right? Then I talked you through saying, hey, in a confined case, you can have LNAPL thickness that's much larger than the what's in the formation, the thickness in the formation, and in the perch case, same thing. You can have a much exaggerated thickness, right? So how can thickness be a good indicator when it's affected by so many things? And that's the metric that we have traditionally used as a measure of recoverability. We also saw this equation in one of Natasha's slides, basically saying NAPL conductivity is a function of all these terms. And just to kind of go over these terms and how this is a very good bulk parameter is these, the density term, rho is density, mu is viscosity. These two terms over here account for the type of product, right? So especially this term, viscosity, makes a distinction whether it's diesel versus gasoline versus heating oil. It'll affect your conductivity of NAPL. That's just a constant. This small k is a measure of your intrinsic permeability. That tells you how coarse grain or fine grain your soil is, right? And this term is relative permeability. And this is a measure of essentially how much LNAPL, in this case, LNAPL, yeah? How much LNAPL you have in the pore space. The more LNAPL you have, the higher this term gets. So NAPL conductivity is kind of an amalgam, or it's an indicator of different things that can affect movement of LNAPL in the ground. So kind of keep that in mind. And let me go back one slide. I think I skipped a slide here. Okay. Yep. So we'll borrow from the groundwater literature. Groundwater folks have been using groundwater transmissivity or water transmissivity as a indicator of putting in a production well forever, right? For a really, really long time. And it's an indication, it's basically transmissivity is an indicator of how much water a formation is able, in this case water, how much water the formation is able to transmit under a gradient of one, unit gradient, over a unit width of the aquifer, right? So how much water can you produce from this cross-section of the aquifer under a unit gradient, it's what's transmissivity. And you can use the same concept, same terminology, same, essentially the same term, transmissivity, just corrected or modified for LNAPL to assess how much LNAPL your formation would produce. So just changing the subscript from the previous slide from TW to TN, you've got, hey, I can tell how much NAPL my formation will transmit if I know what my KN, which we talked about, is kind of a really bulk parameter. It accounts for a lot of things. And what's my NAPL formation thickness in the formation? Not NAPL thickness in the well, but NAPL thickness in the formation. And then if you juggle this a little bit of algebra here, you can get this, how much NAPL is produced from your transmissivity and your gradient that you're applying. And the thickness of BN, I think that's the key thing here, and you'll learn more about it in IBT2, is that BN is not the BN, the thickness in the well, it's a thickness in the formation. So that's a bit tricky to get, but not, but it can be obtained. And that's what goes into your estimates of what you can recover and how much recovery you'll get. So if you've been practicing and your sites have NAPL, some of you, or many of you might have heard this LNAPL transmissivity number of 0.1 to 0.8 square foot per day, or guide, the IBT guide, not the IBT, but the ITRC guide, TechReg, has a recommendation of 0.1 to 0.8 square feet per day. And just to put it in context, what that means in real life, if you have a medium sand with the 100 feet per day hydraulic conductivity kind of material, you can get with gasoline tens of square feet per day. Maybe I've never seen it reach 100, but I've seen it reach 40, 50, right? Square feet per day. As you get to some of the tighter soils of, say, a foot per day type of hydraulic conductivity, you start reaching these numbers of low transmissivity, even when you have a few feet of LNAPL of thickness. So you can have a couple feet of LNAPL in a well, in this particular case, the 0.6 square, 0.6 foot per day type of soil. It's silt loam in this case. So it's fine grained material, but you can get a couple feet of LNAPL and your transmissivity is really low. So you really can't get the LNAPL out in any meaningful way. You'll be able to get it out to a certain amount, just emptying the well, and then come next day or next week and you'll get some more out, but it's really not a whole lot to be recovered from the formation. Okay. So a term that we have used and you've probably heard is residual saturation. So let me first talk about residual saturation just as a fundamental concept, and then I'll discuss it in context of what we're presenting in terms of transmissivity, right? If you take your kitchen sponge and soak it with water, it's got all the pores are filled, and you squeeze it, you get some of the water out, and the water stops dripping at some point, right? And you apply more pressure, you get more out, you apply more pressure, you get more out. At some point, you get to a stage where all the pores are emptied, but the sponge is still wet, right? There's still water in that sponge. At that stage, the sponge has reached, or the water has reached its residual saturation in that sponge material, right? So in the LNAPL case, the equivalent definition of that is what's at the third bullet here, saturation in which the LNAPL becomes discontinuous and is immobilized by capillary forces. Basically, the LNAPL in the formation is discontinuous. It's broken up into blobs, isolated blobs, and when, if you put in a monitoring well, those blobs will not flow into a monitoring well, right? So that is the academic definition of it. From a functional definition, the oil, we look to the oil field folks, where they say the oil that remains in an oil reservoir after depletion or that's reached an economic endpoint, basically what they're saying is at some point you can't get oil out of the formation effectively. You can, right? You'll continue to get NAPL out of the formation till you reach this residual saturation point, but there's a point of diminishing returns. And the ITRC team's saying that the point of diminishing returns happens at about 0.1 to 0.8 square foot per day. In theory, you can get to zero residual saturation, but the energy or the effort that's required to go from that range of 0.1, 0.8 down to zero, even if it were made technically possible, it's just disproportionate, very disproportionate to that effort that will go into it. So one more knowledge check real quick is the site that we've been talking about that had 7 feet of LNAPL in a well. And the water table increase after rainfall, the thickness increase, and you have to make a decision regarding recoverability. Which of these three options actually best informs you that LNAPL would be recoverable? And again, what I'd urge you to do as you put in your answers is think outside the regulatory framework, because whatever regulations require us to do, everybody will comply. You'll need to do it. Just from a technical perspective, you just take that lens. What would make most sense to you? Yeah, I think most of you, at least three quarters of you got it right. So build LNAPL and see how fast it recovers. That's kind of the non-quantitative poor man's indicator of transmissivity, right? When you start measuring on how fast it recovers and how much it recovers in a well, that becomes your transmissivity test. So that's kind of a teaser or setting you up for what you'll hear more in the next IBT. LNAPL is confined, does not need to be recovered. Can't say that till we do the transmissivity test, right? It may not need to be recovered because it's heating oil and it's not going anywhere and it's not, it doesn't have a dissolved plume, but the fact that it's confined really does not, should not inform whether it should be recovered or not. There are other things that probably go into that decision. There are very few of you that said there's a lot of LNAPL in the at the site and should be readily recovered. From a regulatory perspective, that's whatever the regulations would require, but from a, it's probably not what we're looking for in this question. It was basically how would you see if it's recoverable or not. So with that, I will turn it over to Natasha to go over the next key message.
Thanks, Sanjay. So in this key message, we'll be talking just a little bit about sheens. So this is just to give you a bit of an overview about a topic that we're seeing come more into the forefront lately. And I just wanted to point out, I guess I jumped off there too quickly. Particularly related to the causes of sheen. So just because we have a sheen doesn't necessarily mean that we have LNAPL migration. And beyond that as well, we may not have a substantial amount of LNAPL present. So just wanting to kind of ground everyone to start off with that there's a very small amount of hydrocarbon that's needed to produce a sheen. So there's two different types of sheens that we typically think of. We're focused here on petroleum sheens. And these originate, obviously, from LNAPL that can often be in the sediments of the groundwater-surface water interface. It's also worth pointing out that there are naturally occurring sheens from organics usually in stagnant waters or creeks or ditches and things like that. And we can tell them apart pretty easily by using a stick test. So if you put a stick in the sheen and kind of swirl it around, if it's a hydrocarbon sheen, it'll swirl around that stick. And if it is a biologic sheen, it'll fracture. So very different behaviors, but on the surface, they can often look quite similar. But obviously, they have very different implications, so important to think about what is the source of the sheen. And you can go into more detail, too, and collect samples and send them off to the lab to analyze them if you need that as well. So thinking about sheen release mechanisms, in the first case, you can have a seep. So here, as shown on the left, the groundwater discharges into our surface water that carries an LNAPL sheen along with it. The second release mechanism is ebullition. And so in this case, we have an LNAPL at some depth that's undergoing biodegradation or undergoing natural source zone depletion. Those biodegradation processes produce gases like methane and carbon dioxide. And those gas bubbles can then be covered in a thin film of hydrocarbon. And when the hydrocarbon, or when the gas bubble and the hydrocarbon moves up to the surface and the gas bubble pops, then that can cause a sheen as that hydrocarbon then is present in the surface water. And then the third release mechanism is erosion. So in this case, we have LNAPL in the sediments that becomes exposed and is then in contact with the water column. And so then this can also cause a sheen to be observed in the surface water without erosion. So the key message here really is that transport of LNAPL to surface water is not necessarily gradient driven, as well as some other implications for, you know, what the sheen might be caused from. But just thinking that it doesn't necessarily need to be like this large release that's causing some sort of gradient and moving that hydrocarbon to the water body. There's the other things that can be going on that are worth keeping in mind. And I'll pass it back to Sanjay.
All right, the home stretch here. The last key message is that biological processes are important. We did a study, just looked back on sites and looked at the concentrations and dissolved phase and how much DO, nitrate, sulfate, et cetera, the site had. And, it's very easy to do. I mean, these concentrations are usually, you get a typical range and you can calculate how much biodegradation capacity a groundwater has. Right, from a traditional aerobic anaerobic degradation pathway. And that's what we had believed and done for quite a while, because that the M&A world, we say, okay, chemicals like BTECs dissolve and then they meet oxygen, nitrate, sulfate, et cetera, and they degrade. And that capacity is of the order of few tens of gallons per acre per year, right? So keep that number in mind, 50 gallons per acre per year. Trying to advance my slide here. Okay, and there's a lot of publications that have come out. This one's by Natasha, but there are others as well. And if you look at these numbers, what people are measuring is of the order of 1,000, maybe few hundred to few thousand gallons per acre per year. So compare this, let's say the 1,000, just kind of make a point, right? So compare this 1,000 gallons per acre per year with the 50 that we can account for from a traditional understanding. There's a difference, there's a gap, that something's got to explain that gap. And before it became into the mainstream industry, there were people in academia and in USGS kind of saying, hey, there's another path that you should be looking at. Look at your vapor flux. And it's not just a volatile compound, but there's CO2 coming out of here and methane coming out of here. You should be looking at that to really account for how much is degrading. And these are a whole bunch of publications, even the ITRC 2009. So that's what, 12, 13 years back, and this paper's as back as 30 years back now. Acknowledging that, but it took a while for it to really get into the mainstream. So now what we understand in the current conceptual model is, and there's a lot of papers that have some version of this, is that in the source zone area, there's another process that's happening, which is methanogenesis. And these bugs are directly, these are called methanogens, they're directly working on your hydrocarbon or your LNAPL. And they are producing carbon dioxide and methane that's coming out of the source zone. And in some cases, there may be VOCs coming out, just depending on what kind of LNAPL there is, right? And all these gases, the blend of these gases kind of starts moving up toward the surface. And there's a zone where they meet some oxygen, and there's another set of bugs out there called methanotrophs, and they chew up this methane and VOCs that are coming up. And what you see coming out of the surface at the end is CO2. right? And there are different ways of measuring this. There's some methods that measure the CO2 that comes out of the surface. There's some methods that measure the heat. But the point here is, more importantly, that this NAPL gets degraded by methanogenesis, and it's a important process that we had been ignoring for some time. This was a very intriguing couple papers that I looked at. My understanding always, at least when I did my degrees, was that things have to dissolve in water to degrade. And you look at this paper, this is from USGS Barbara Beacons, and anything that's got a pink circle on it is an alkane. It basically has very little solubility. And the blue circles are these isoprenoid, these are kind of biomarkers and some things that just don't degrade at all, right? And over a period of, I don't know how many years, I don't recall off the top of my head, but over a period of a few years, you see things that are these pink circles, those peaks have gone down. So chemicals that are not soluble in water are depleting quite rapidly here. And then I found this paper, Huan Wang, actually should be Huan Wang, 2014, they kind of took pictures in an electron micrograph, microscope, kind of showing that there are bacteria that are attaching directly to the oil droplets. So they kind of explain the mechanism, saying that chemicals don't have to dissolve to really deplete. Bugs will find food and they'll eat it regardless of whether it's through the water or directly in that space. And there's some more detail in this paper on what the mechanisms are, which I'm not going to cover in the interest of time. So basically, all kinds of chemicals in LNAPL, not all kinds, these are isoprenoids that don't, but most of the mixture depletes through the traditional MNA path, the electron acceptors, or through methanogens, or methanogenesis. So just the whole sections, the different sections that we covered, where a lot of these were just setting the basics for you to be ready and prepared and thinking about some of these. If you need to read up, probably read up in preparation of the IBT2. So to kind of wrap it all, you've seen the slide before. It's in the general terminology, it's all LNAPL. If you have got lots of it, at least in relative terms, if you've got pores that is continuously accumulates in a well, it's migrating, it's mobile. And if it's moving, then it's migrating. At some point it becomes residual, that kind of squeeze sponge where you can't recover it anymore, but it's still there, right? So throughout this entire range, regardless of how much is there, you can have composition concerns. So if you have gasoline, you would probably have similar concerns with gasoline at this stage and this stage, and maybe even the leftmost stage, because you are worried about what's happening to your vapor, what's happening to your dissolved phase, right? In addition to whether it's moving. And if you are in the mobile migrating stage, then you're also got saturation concerns. Is my LNAPL moving? Can I get more of it out from the ground? So I think understanding your LNAPL, how much it is, what it is, and where it is kind of important. And we've kind of formed a basis of helping you think through that today, and you'll build on this more in the upcoming IBT. With that, I think I hand over to Randy.
Hey, Randy, you're still muted. Randy, you are still muted.
Am I muted now?
No, you are good muted now. Nope, you're good.
Sorry about that, everybody. And I had the greatest joke. No, sorry. As always, Natasha and Sanjay, thank you very much. You always do a great job, and thank you for your time and effort today. Again, to everybody, last two slides here. Next, this is a lot this week. I know that, but again, it's important that you understand the key concepts. Next week, we're going to talk about building the conceptual site model. That's going to be a big portion of it. And what we would ask if you guys could do for us is for next week, before you go into get there, if you could start thinking about your cases and the key concepts, and I can't forward it, Devin, for some reason, it's not letting me forward. But if you guys can think about the things that we talked about today by Natasha and Sanjay and how it might apply to your sites and how it, if you have any really tough sites, and how now understanding some of those key components and those key concepts will help you maybe address or relook at those things in a different way. And that's always important. And I will just reiterate a word that Sanjay just used, the composition. I think that's a big thing. Don't get wrapped around the axle just because there's LNAPL there. But if you can think about it, is it, okay, fine if there's LNAPL, but is it a composition issue? Is that something that we can address? I think it will really help you guys. But I'm going to pass it on to Devin to close out. And I do know that there's a couple of questions that folks have. But again, always on behalf of ITRC, thank you very much. And Sanjay and Natasha, again, thank you.
Thank you, Randy. And thank you, Sanjay and Natasha, for that second part of our training today. We will begin with we'll finish up with our last live Q&A. Our first question, another composition question. What analytical methods would you use to understand the composition of a weathered LNAPL? Sanjay, you're muted right now. There you go.
Gas chromatography, mass spec, GCMS, they should be able to tell you what's in your LNAPL. There's some, I think most labs are able to do that. And I don't know the method number. I don't know if there's a method number, but it's kind of a standard analysis.
Thank you, Sanjay. All right, next question. If you properly install a monitoring well or recovery well within an LNAPL plume, and the LNAPL is either migrating or mobile, is it possible while you recover LNAPL using any appropriate technology to actually pull the LNAPL plume boundaries back towards the well? In other words, reduce its footprint.
I think it applies to the section that Natasha presented. So I'm kind of. All right, maybe she's having some difficulty. I'll try, but if Natasha is back online or she can join, then that'll be great too. In principle, yes. If you have enough connectivity between where your well is pumping and the fringe of the plume, then you can. But if for some reason that connectivity is destroyed because of fluctuation of water table or things like that, then no, you have to be, whatever you're pumping and whatever you're trying to affect, they should be in quote unquote NAPL connectivity within the pores. There should be a conduit for NAPL to flow to your pump. And that conduit can be broken by fluctuation of the water and snap offs.
All right. Natasha's phone might have disconnected. She was having some computer issues, but I'll look out for her if she gets back in. Thank you, Sanjay. All right, next question. What can be done when LNAPL transmissivity is low, but LNAPL has to be removed for regulatory conformance?
All right, so I'll answer it as a RP, and then I'll I'll kind of pass it to Randy to answer that as a regulator. As an RP, you must comply, so we'll comply. Right, so whatever's needed to meet the regulatory regulatory conformance, the RPs will do it. But Randy, do you want to build on to it as the kind of the other side of the table.
Okay, this is the, and again, every state's going to be different. Every state is going to be different regarding the what is required and what isn't required. But this gets back into, I think, in my opinion here, and this is coming from my program, look at the lines of evidence. Again, and it goes back to those SMART objectives. Just because something is there, just like the question we just had about putting a well in the middle of an LNAP footprint. Okay, fine. It may have extended out to a certain amount because the mass pushed it out. But now that it's there, maybe you don't need to spend that energy and effort and that kind of time to bring it back. Maybe it's a composition change. Maybe just you degrade the footprint as it is. But again, unfortunately, every state's going to be different. Every regulatory program is going to be different. So I can't tell you that there's going to be one or another, but certainly I would encourage everyone to look at the lines of evidence. If the transmissivity is X, but all of these other pieces of evidence are indicating that it's not migrating, that it's not off-gassing, that let's say maybe it's an old plume and then the dissolving components are such that we don't get a large component of the carcinogens and things like that. All those things come into play when you're having that conversation. But unfortunately, we have 50 different states and we have 50 different interpretations of what is regulatorily required. certainly my encouragement would be to anybody to look at the lines of evidence and bring everything to the conversation so that even though one may be of an issue for a program, if there's other pieces of evidence that will help you have a good dialogue, and that's going to be helpful.
Thank you, Randy and Sanjay. Next question. Can ebullition, slide 86, be seen in water columns? Can they be at the surface, shake and fall back into the column, then float back to the top again?
Let me see slide 86. Okay. Ebullition, I guess when there's a water column, assuming it's got some soil and NAPL at the bottom of it and this standing water on top. So that's my mental picture of this question. And if that water column reaches a methanogenesis, when I say water column, soil column with water on top, reaches in methanogenesis state, you can have bubbles come up to the top. But ebullition is basically gas bubbles that are being released as part of natural depletion. And there's a film of NAPL that kind of coats that air bubble and pops to the surface. I think that was a context that Natasha presented this in. So for it to be, what was the question again? It can go back down, right? It's a gas, it comes up, brings the oil with it, comes to the surface, it pops, the gas goes to the environment or to the atmosphere and the bubble becomes a sheen on the surface. So I'm hoping that I'm answering it. If not, then ask again.
Thank you, Sanjay. Okay, next question. Is sheen indicative of mobile NAPL?
I think that was, again, responding for Natasha, that was the message here, not necessarily, right? That's not the only mechanism where sheens can occur. That's one mechanism where LNAPL can travel to the kind of water surface through migration. Sorry, let me look at the question again. What, it was mobile or migrating?
Mobile NAPL.
Okay. So my answer is still the same. It's not necessarily. You could have, for example, you can have residual LNAPL and erosion, and that'll cause a sheen. You could have ebullition in a residually trapped LNAPL area, and that gas bubble that gets released can bring a coating of oil from below, and that'll cause the sheen. So LNAPL doesn't have to be mobile for sheens to occur.
Okay. Thank you. About LNAPL transmissivity, are there specific well requirements like filter length for assessing it? Should assessment be done on monitoring wells installed specifically for that? I heard that to evaluate LNAPL recoverability, it would be necessary to take LNAPL transmissivity from pumping wells. Is that correct? Apologies
Don't need special wells. It doesn't have to be a pumping well. You can do transmissivity measurement out of your monitoring wells. So no special wells needed as long as they are constructed properly. That means they should be intercepting your mobile NAPL area, right? So the screen should be intercepting it. The well should be properly developed. And that's kind of a high level answer. There's a lot more discussion on transmissivity in IBT2.
A few more questions, and then that is all we have time for. How will an improperly screened well affect LNAPL thickness in a monitoring well? For example, a well where LNAPL and water levels are above the top of the screen.
So submerged screen. I think it's kind of the similar response to the first one. Your screen interval should intercept where your mobile interval is in the formation, mobile LNAPL intervals, right? So if the screen if the well is screened in the wrong place, it won't reflect what's in the formation. It won't even, the LNAPL won't even flow into the well depending on where the LNAPL sits relative to your screen. The well development is also an important thing. I mean, over time, these packs get plugged up. So well development is important. So again, I think it's a similar response to this question as the previous question.
Okay, thank you. In the paper by Hua, did they find Pseudomonas. Thank you. Bacteria active in both the saturated and unsaturated soils?
I don't recall if there was any discussion on the unsaturated soils. Specifically that paper, I don't think it goes into unsaturated soil. There's probably other literature out there, especially in the petroleum vapor intrusion world. A lot of people have done work to kind of show there is enough biodegradation happening in the unsaturated zone as well. But that paper, I don't know for sure, but I don't recall seeing it. It's been a long time that I've seen that paper again.
Thank you. One last question. Are the MNA processes in LNAPL the same as, say, a dissolved plume in groundwater?
I think that's a terminology difference, MNA versus NSZD, right? So the biological processes are the additional biological process that's more relevant, more important in the LNAPL area is methanogenesis. So in the MNA world, we look at electron acceptors, like oxygen, nitrate, sulfate, iron. Whereas in the source area, in addition to all that, which only accounts for 50 gallons per acre per year, there's another 1,000 gallons per acre per year that's happening because of methanogens.
Okay. We had one last question come in, and we do have a minute to spare, so I will read it, and then we can wrap up the training. Methane is fairly soluble in water, about 23 milligrams per liter. Methane is generated as a dissolved phase reaction, methogenesis. How confident are we that dissolved methane will generate methane gas bubbles in the subsurface?
No, that's a good point. I mean, you have to exceed solubility for it to show up in another phase, or when the bubbles are generated, if they are close to the surface, that they don't get enough time to dissolve, then it may express itself as at the surface. But the numbers that we are seeing in the kind of at the surface measurements in SCO2 basically indicate that the groundwater concentrations have already reached or are near the methane solubility.
All right, and with that, we will that concludes our second question and answer portion of the training today. Participants, thank you very much for attending and asking our trainers those questions. And trainers, thank you for providing your answers. If you need any further clarification on any questions, or if you have any more questions, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. You are also welcome to follow up with our trainers directly. Just a reminder that ITRC archives all of its training classes, so if you have any additional time or want any other trainings, please look at all of our classes on Cluin. Once again, thank you to our trainers for being here today, and that wraps up our LNAPL 1 training. We will see you for part 2 next week.